The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Oh, good. I'm glad there's a crowd tonight. I got a little worried. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm the program director here. Before we start, if you could just turn off the cell phones, the dryers, the beepers, all that, things of that nature. A little housekeeping before we meet Tony Jutt. If you have tickets for Harry Frankfurt, that event was canceled due to an illness that he has, and he's not going to reschedule the event. So if you have tickets, you'll get something from us in the mail. That will say, you'll get it later this week, but essentially you'll be able to select from about three lectures that we will have in the spring. And if those don't fit the bill for you, you can either donate the ticket back and we'll acknowledge that, or we can give you a refund for it. But as I said, those of you who purchase tickets will receive something in the mail later in the week. Also, we've added a free event on Tuesday, December 19th at 7 p.m., Newsweek editor and historian Evan Thomas will be here to speak about his latest bestseller. It's called Sea of Thunder, Four Commanders and the Last Great Naval Campaign, 1941 to 1945. And as you can tell, we can't seem to escape the long shadow of World War II, as tonight's speaker will make abundantly clear. Tony Jutt was educated at King's College, Cambridge, and the École Normale Supérieure, Paris, and has taught at Cambridge, Oxford, Berkeley, and currently New York University, where he is the Eric Maria Remarque Professor of European Studies, as well as the director of the Remarque Institute. He is the author of 11 books and is also a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books, the Times Literary Supplement, the New York Times, and many journals in Europe and the U.S. The lion's share of you are probably most familiar with his latest book, Post-War, which the New York Times named as one of their 10 best books of 2005, declaring, "Jutt's massive, learned, brilliantly detailed account of Europe's recovery from the wreckage of World War II presents a whole continent in panorama, even as it sets off detonations of insight on almost every page." Please welcome Tony Jutt.
Good evening. Thank you very much indeed for that. Is this working okay? Can you hear me? Oh, lovely. Good. As you've just been told, I recently wrote a history of post-war Europe, and I'm going to talk about that for the next half an hour or so. But I'll be happy also to talk afterwards about questions connected with it, some of which I'll raise in what I have to say, and others of which you may wish to raise. I think anyone in my generation, and there are lots of people in my generation because I was born right in the middle of the baby boom, will have a fairly clear sort of conventional idea of what the history of post-war Europe looks like. In 1945, the worst war in European history came to an end. In the German phrase, 1945 was Stunde Null, zero hour. Everything ended then, and everything new began then. The history of the period from then until 1990 was typically treated primarily as the history of a divided Europe, East and West, which went on so long that for anyone who, like myself, grew up in Western Europe, or indeed who grew up in this country, the division just seemed natural. It was obvious that there was an East Europe and a West Europe, and it would last, so far as anyone knew, indefinitely. And the other conventional assumption, of course, about the history of this period is that it's dominated on both sides of the wall, as it were, by the Cold War. So this is the history of Europe subsumed into the history of the Cold War. I think also that most people who think about Europe in this period at all are familiar with a sort of happy tale of European recovery and European Union, as though Europeans collectively woke up in 1945, realized what they had done to themselves and to the world in the previous 50 years, 45 years, turned over a new leaf, created the European Union, or first the European Community and then the European Union, with this abolished European conflicts, European war, and some American eyes went a little too far in their enthusiasm for abolishing the idea of war. And the outcome was the prosperous, stable Europe that we know today. And then, I suppose also to round out the conventional story, there is the sense widespread, I think, today in this country, but also in Europe, particularly Western Europe, not Eastern Europe, for reasons I'll talk about, that somehow the whole of this period is shadowed by the greatest crime in European history, that is, the destruction of the European Jews, the Holocaust, and that everything that we know about post-war Europe and everything that Europeans know or don't know or know but don't want to admit about themselves grows out of the memory of that event, of what was done in Europe to the Jews between 40 and 45. And connected in a funny kind of way with that is, and this is my last sort of marker point of the conventional version that I want to talk against for a little while, is the idea that somehow the United States is very much bound up with this European history, not only in obvious ways in having fought the Second World War and having devoted a large part, much largest part of its military resources to fighting in Europe, having contributed massively to the Marshall Plan, having obviously played the dominant role in the Cold War and so on, so that the history of Europe and the history of the United States in these years, in these decades, are in some sense bound together, even if they now appear on both sides of the Atlantic to be unraveling. What I want to do, and what I tried to do in the book post-war, was shift the emphases a little bit, tell that story a little bit differently, and let me summarize how I did that, or what I was trying to do at least, in the next few minutes. Firstly, the Second World War didn't end in 1945. A war on that scale, a war which in most of the countries where it took place was not a conventional war, but a war of destruction against civilians. A war where the physical and human damage was greater than that of any other war in recorded history, doesn't end just because the fighting stops. I was born in 1948 and I grew up in England, which was a country, one of the few belligerent countries that was not occupied and therefore not damaged in the way that the occupied countries were damaged. And yet even growing up in England, I can remember well into the early mid-50s playing as a child on bomb sites because a large part of London, as well as other cities, were still not yet rebuilt. And so there were large empty areas. We called them bomb sites and we played on them, even though in fact it was quite dangerous and often forbidden because there were, of course, unexploded bombs still around. And rationing survived well into the early 1950s. My mother tells me a story that I think is true because I have a vague recollection of it myself, that long after sugar rationing came off in the early 50s, she managed to convince me that it was still on. And that all the kids in school who somehow had access to candy and the like were getting it because their parents were getting black market sugar rations. And since I knew perfectly well what black market sugar rations were, I was happy to believe that. And I think it was well into the second year after rationing was abolished that I twigged. We grew up in the shadow of the war. And if we in England grew up in the shadow of the war, you can well imagine that people in Germany, in France, in Italy, in Poland, in Yugoslavia grew up in the shadow of that war. No one knew there wasn't going to be a Third World War. Above all, no one knew there wasn't going to be a revival of fascism. The great, this is one of the many small differences, and I'll try to bring out a few in a little while, between Europe and the States. The great fear in Europe was a revival of fascism, not of communism. The assumption, after all, was that the only sort of example you had of how great wars end was the end of the First World War, in which there were civil wars, revolutions, economic catastrophe, leading to economic depression, nationalism, street violence, and the rise of fascism. Why would it not happen again? The Second World War had been much worse than the First. So there was a widespread assumption that doesn't really fade away until the early 50s, 51, 52, that the thing to watch out for, the thing to fight against, the thing to prevent was a return to the 1930s, with the economics of the 30s and therefore the politics of the 30s. And in that sense, Europeans, West Europeans, lived in the shadow of the Second World War for nearly a decade after it ended, not even dealing with countries like Greece, where the civil war that had been triggered by the war continued, in fact, to 1949 anyway. Eastern Europeans, one could argue, lived under the shadow of the Second World War in very particular ways until 1989. And in that sense, the Second World War is permanently present in the history of post-war Europe. Remember that it's a war with no peace treaty. There was no definitive ending to the Second World War among the main combatant powers. There were small treaties regarding Italy and Yugoslavia and one or two of the East European countries. There was no big treaty regarding Germany because Moscow and Washington and London couldn't agree on it. And so in a sense, the Second World War didn't end in many ways. That's why there were so many troops in Germany from both sides until 1990. But there are other differences that I want to push a little bit on and point you towards. There are differences, for example, that go well beyond the East-West conventional distinction. Let me point to one of them, the difference between neutral countries and engaged countries. There were neutral countries in Europe, as you know, in the Second World War: Sweden, Switzerland, Portugal. They did, particularly the first two, astonishingly well out of the war. If you stop the clock in 1939, Sweden is in the poorer half of European countries, and Switzerland is somewhere in the middle by conventional measures of national wealth. By the end of the 1950s, they're both in the top four, and they stay there forever. They did remarkably well from the war, profiting technically from trading with the Germans, especially the Swedes trading in raw materials and the Swiss processing money. They also did well simply by not doing badly, if you think about it. The difference between being neutral and being engaged is an important element in the memory that Europeans have of the war, and the experience is one of the reasons why still, if you go to Norway, you can very quickly, particularly if you go outside of the world of people like us, but go to the countryside, go to non-foreign language speaking Norwegians and so on, ask them what they think about Swedes. And 2 centimeters below the surface, they come out lots of things, but one of them is the Second World War. And the difference between what happened to Norway, which was catastrophic, and what happened to Sweden, which was marvelous. Then, and overlapping with this distinction, there is the distinction between those countries which were occupied and those which were not occupied. Some countries were not occupied. Great Britain wasn't occupied. Southern France wasn't occupied until November 1942. Other countries were occupied from the very beginning. Northern France, Holland, Belgium, Poland, Czechoslovakia, of course, Yugoslavia from 1941, and so on. And occupation in the Second World War meant much more than it did in the First World War or any previous war. It meant, firstly, that very often the occupier, primarily the Germans, but in the latter part of the war, the Russians, of course, exploited internal divisions to their own advantage so that you get civil wars operating under the guise of resistance or collaboration. In Italy, what we think of and Italians proudly used to think of as the resistance was in fact a very small number of Italians. And what they used to think of as primarily the microscopic pro-German fascists were in fact quite a large number of Italians. And the two of them fought each other viciously in the last 2 years of the war in northern Italy, in what was effectively a civil war, though of course it's referred to in Italian history books as the resistance struggle, and there were many such cases. Occupation meant the destruction of local authority, the destruction of the rule of law, encouragement to sell out your neighbors. If your neighbors were Jewish, encouragement to steal the goods in their houses once they'd been kicked out. Occupation essentially unraveled the fabric of civil society. Occupied countries, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Italy, arguably France, emerged from the Second World War in a condition which was morally even more catastrophic than it was physically catastrophic. They knew they had collaborated in many, many cases, people, or if they hadn't collaborated, they'd kept their heads down and turned away from things that they wouldn't have approved of under normal circumstances. They no longer had any respect for government, because government meant collaboration and the occupying regime or the collaborating local politicians. The rule of law had been turned upside down. The only way to survive in a country like Poland was to break the law, to steal, to ignore the law that forbade your children to go to school, to, if you wanted to behave in a manner which remotely resembled civilized society, you had to break the law because it meant you had to speak to people you were forbidden to speak to, help people you were forbidden to help, and so on. And so these European countries, these occupied countries, emerge humiliated and with a very different attitude towards government and a very different sense of uncertainty and distrust towards neighbors, literal neighbors, but also, of course, your political neighbors, members of other political parties, and so on. Then there are countries, and it sort of overlaps with occupied and unoccupied, that had good wars and those that had bad wars. Most Europeans had a bad war. The English had a very good war, at least they thought they did, and we learnt it that way, because what came out of the Second World War was the idea that we all were in it together and that there were equal sacrifices, that no compromises were made, and on top of that, we won. That's loosely, except in certain marginal ways, what the Russian story was as well. The one thing that the Soviet Union and that particular generation, the greatest generation in Soviet history, had going for it and shared in common with the English was the sense that they fought a great war. They, in fact, won the Second World War in Europe. The English and the Americans didn't. And they knew it, and they sacrificed hugely to win it. And so there's a Soviet sense that the Second World War was in some ways a good war. Physically catastrophic in human terms, but something proud to look back on. That's not obviously going to be true in most other countries, either because they didn't fight a good war, or because they lost catastrophically, or because there was a civil war. Germany is an interesting mixed case. The generation of Germans who emerged from the Second World War, who were born, let's say, around 1920, and who had been adults, fighting adults if they were men, in the Second World War, were not, in fact, embarrassed or ashamed of their Second World War. That comes much, 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 much later. They weren't allowed to be proud of it in public, but in fact they were. And so they immediately latched onto the idea that somehow they were the victims, victims of Hitler for having led them to lose when they should have won, or led them into a war that ultimately they couldn't win, victims of the Allies, particularly the Russians, because of the way the Russians treated especially German women in the occupation, and victims of victors' justice, Nuremberg and so on, which forbade them to be proud of having fought astonishingly bravely, which of course is true as well. And so there was a complicated story there in German memory, which is very different from the memory of the French, for example, or the Dutch. We'll come back to the Dutch. There's a generational issue here as well. And this moves me on from the war and the echo of the war into the post-war years. I mentioned that I was a member of the baby boom. And statistically, the chances are that there's a disproportionate number of baby boomers in this room just because we are the biggest generation in the history of modern demography. But we were the children of the smallest generation in the history of modern demography. This is the point I want to make. Our parents kept on dying, if you think of it that way. They kept on being killed in the First World War, in the civil wars and revolutionary violence that followed, and of course again under fascism and in the Second World War. And insofar as they survived, they often didn't have children, normally because there wasn't a man available to marry the woman who might otherwise have had children because of the death rate for men in the First World War. They didn't marry because they often didn't have the means to marry anyway. And if they had children, they didn't have many of them because they couldn't afford them. So that you have a curious pattern in before World War II of a very small generation, very small cohort, which shrinks again, of course, because of the Second World War, giving birth in the years 1947 to 1952 to a huge cohort. The birth rate in France, in Italy, in Poland, in England, a little later in the United States, was greater than at any point in modern history. And this is going to matter, of course, in the story later on. Because in the 60s, you have a generation of people who are going to become students, who are huge in numbers, and who have been born into a period of astonishing and unprecedented prosperity. But they are the children of parents who grew up in an era of unusual insecurity and economic depression and military catastrophe. And so that generation gap is a much bigger gap, psychologically, demographically, materially, than at any previous point in at least modern Western society. And I think one wants to bring this out. It's just as important a distinction as the distinction between East and West, occupied and unoccupied, or good and bad wars, or whatever. All generations have gaps, but previous generations essentially lived very similarly to their parents. If you look at photographs of my parents' generation, they're wearing the same clothes as their parents' generation. They experienced essentially a similar life. They thought of themselves as modern and their parents as antediluvian and so on. But in fact, they're wearing the same clothes. They left school at the same period of time. They've got the same life expectancy and the same professional, occupational job prospects. It's our generation for whom everything opened up in ways that our parents found very hard to imagine. Our parents' generation happy merely to accept security rather than to expect endlessly increased prosperity. And this generation gap, which is at its peak in the 60s when the baby boom enters universities, has a large role to play in the history of the 60s as we conventionally remember it and conceive it. And then on the question of memory, it's important to recall, and this is a point I alluded to at the beginning, that what is now for us the most important thing that happened in the 20th century, and the shadow of which hangs heavy over European identity today, was utterly unimportant in the initial post-war decades. And I mean, of course, the Holocaust. No one wanted, really, to know about the Holocaust in the 1940s, 50s, or early 60s. That's true in this country as well, by the way, but we're talking about Europe. Primo Levi. I assume most people in this room are familiar with Primo Levi, survival in Auschwitz. He came out of Auschwitz, made his way back to Italy, and by his own account, sat down, and more or less at one sitting, physically had no choice but to write down the memory of what he had seen and experienced. And he called it Si questo è un uomo, if this is a man. And then he tried to find a publisher, 1946. He went to the great Italian left-wing resistance publisher, Einaudi, but the senior editor there turned it down, saying that no one wanted to hear about the suffering of Jews now. Resistance stories, yes, stories of heroism, stories that were uplifting, could tell you something good about the prospects for Italy, sure, but stories of Jews who had no choice but to suffer and mostly died anyway, no. The editor, by the way, is Natalia Ginzburg, herself Jewish, very famous writer in her own right, and the widow of a dead resistance hero in Italy at the time. Levi finally found a small publisher in Turin who published or printed 1,500 copies, nearly all of which were immediately remaindered. They were put in a warehouse in Florence and washed away in the floods of the Arno River in 1966. It wasn't until the late 1950s that he was able to get Einaudi, the big publisher I've referred to take the book on. And it wasn't until the 60s that he could get foreign translations, if this is a man, the English translation, Survival in Auschwitz, the American translation. And it wasn't until the 1980s that French and German publishers were willing to put Levy into French. So we shouldn't give you Primo Levi just as one example, because he is so accessible, so well known, that it's hard for us to imagine that from 1945 through the early 60s, he couldn't get a publisher, couldn't get read, and no one wanted to know. But in fact, his story is utterly typical. The French, the Belgians, passed laws that said that all kinds of pensions and privileges and rewards were available to the resistance heroes who returned from deportation to the German camps, or their families if they'd been killed in the camps. But you had to be deported as a resistor. Being deported as a Jew didn't count. Being deported as a Jewish resistor was fine, but merely being deported as such was not evidence of having resisted. And it's not again until the 60s, with the Eichmann trial in Israel, with the Auschwitz trials of camp commanders in Germany in 1963-65, that a new generation becomes for the first time more sensitive to these issues. One of the consequences of this forgotten or semi-forgotten history, because no one's really comfortable thinking back to the history of a subject that was not acknowledged very much. Remember that at the Nuremberg trials after the war, the destruction of the Jews was not one of the points that in the accusation. Both the Russians and the French were reluctant to make that a theme in the trials. And in fact, the French, François de Menton, who was the senior French prosecutor, never once mentioned the word Jew throughout his moving, emotional prosecution of the Germans for crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and so on. Now, of course, and it's a point I make in the epilogue of the book, in fact, that's what the epilogue's about, Europeans have in common, if they have something in common, precisely their shared acknowledgement of what happened in World War II, what was done primarily to European Jews. And as a result, we've forgotten something. We've forgotten that the Second World War was not about the Jews. There are only two groups of people for whom the Second World War was about killing Jews. One was Jews and the others was the Nazis. For everyone else, it was about surviving in one form or another, or maybe indirectly benefiting from other people's sufferings. And we are telling a bad history, rewriting the past. If we reinsert the history of the destruction of the Jews at the center of what was going on, it was, and this makes the story even worse in a way, of course, peripheral. And I can tell you just how peripheral, because I grew up in England. I'm Jewish. I grew up in England. I went to Cambridge University, and I studied French history, 1966-67. And I read about Vichy. And we read about Vichy France, and the books about Vichy France then, both the English language books and the French language books, didn't mention Vichy's active, proactive collaboration in the destruction of the French Jews and the sending of 74,000 Jews to their death in Germany. No mention of that. Now, that's not surprising. What is surprising, as I look back on it, is that it didn't surprise me. And it's all the more surprising because I lost some of my family as a result of what the French were doing in the Second World War. And even then, knowing that, somehow one lives in sort of a sort of split mental universe. One knows what happened privately, but publicly, being taught about the Second World War without much reference to those events didn't seem strange. And if it didn't seem strange to me, it's no wonder it didn't seem strange to most Europeans, who were not, of course, directly implicated, their families not affected. Now, everything I've said so far is about Western Europe. Eastern Europe is different. And in this one crucial respect, the East-West division really matters. And that is because most of the worst things that happened in Europe in the Second World War, and that could not be forgotten because there were so many of them, happened in Eastern Europe. The death camps were mostly in Poland. Most of the killing fields of Europe, both of Jews and others, were in Serbia, Croatia, Slovakia, Ukraine, Romania, Poland, and the Baltic countries. You couldn't be in those countries and not know what had happened. And there was indeed frequent and statistically accurate memorialization in Eastern Europe of what happened, but with one exception. If anyone, maybe some people here did, if anyone visited the camp at Auschwitz, the museum at Auschwitz, before the end of communism, you would have seen a very moving memorial to German crimes against humanity, to the abuse of the prisoners, to the extermination of them. The numbers are accurate. The information is terrible. But it's given exclusively in national terms. The number of Hungarians killed, the number of Poles killed, the number of Belgians killed, the number of etc. The word Jew doesn't figure. And this is certainly not because of any active desire to block out that fact or that memory, but because politically what was much more important was the memory of what Germans had done to the local population. And from the Soviet point of view, and of course this is now Soviet-controlled Eastern Europe after 1945, the important thing was to emphasize that this was an anti-fascist war in which the Soviet Union had rescued Eastern Europe from the grips of Germanic barbaric fascism. It wasn't about race. It was about class, and it wasn't about religion, if you like. It was about ideology. And so in Eastern Europe, adapting since 1989 to the Western memory, which is now fully and indeed sort of obsessively taken up with the memory of what was done in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe to Jews, East Europeans had great trouble adapting to it because for them, the history of that suffering is the history of their suffering. And to be told that they've got to rethink of it as primarily an experience of Jewish victimhood creates all kinds of complications that you can imagine. And so that's one of the crucial ways in which since 1989, Europe remains divided, and even the European Union, despite the many members from Eastern Europe who are now fully integrated in it, is effectively split by a different memory, or if at the very least, a different sort of balance of memories and different times in which those memories operate between East and West. Two other things that I'd like to draw your attention to. In this book, I don't place perhaps as much emphasis as other people have in histories of Europe on the United States, as I said at the beginning. This is not because United States doesn't matter in the story. That's obviously not true. There's a whole chapter on the Marshall Plan and so on. But Europe had a very different experience of the post-war years from the United States. And I think the best way to understand that is to think in a slightly different key. The 20th century in Europe and the 20th century in this country were utterly, utterly different. We forget that because in the post-war years, the Cold War, the East-West division, NATO, the Atlantic Alliance, the natural assumption of common Western values, common Western institutions, blurs the distinction. But think of it this way. For the 20th century European, you have three generations of experience of catastrophe. War, civil war, occupation, violence, revolutions. The primary measure of 20th century European history is death rates. On the first day of the Battle of the Somme in 1916, July the 1st, 1916, the British Army lost 60,000 men. That's more than the Americans lost in the whole of the Vietnam War in 24 hours. Or take the French, who we perhaps a little too quickly assume gave up without a fight in the Second World War. When the Germans invaded northern France and defeated the country in 6 weeks between April and June 1940. The French army lost 112,000 men in those 6 weeks, dead in fighting. That's double, almost exactly double, what the United States lost in the Vietnam War in 6 weeks. So that the European measure of the price of war has been catastrophically greater than that of the American experience in the 20th century. The other thing is that most European countries have a memory now, still living memory for many people, of civil war. The civil war in Yugoslavia, obviously, most recently, but the civil wars that characterized the Second World War, civil war in Greece that came afterwards, civil war in Spain just before the Second World War, and so on. And civil wars are particularly awful, not only because civilians are the primary victims, but because when the war's finished, everyone is still there. The enemy is still there, as it were, on both sides. And Europeans are very conscious of the cost of civil war and the political and economic institutions necessary to prevent it or diminish the risk of it. Now, Americans have, of course, a memory of the cost of civil war, but it's not a 20th century memory, it's a 19th century memory. And it's primarily a southern memory. So that it's been lost by now, except in history and literature. And so Americans and Europeans look back on a very different 20th century. And you can see this in the American assumption, still present today, I think, that other things equal, things will work out well. Whereas Europeans, certainly Europeans of the generation that I'd experienced or remembered, or in my case was taught about, the 30s and 40s, begin with the assumption that if you're not careful, things will work out badly. Secondly, I think there is the assumption in the American case that maybe may change with this generation, that war, on the whole, produces good outcomes or at any rate solves problems. Europeans have good reason, historically, to believe otherwise. As I said, the only two countries in Europe where that claim will get a positive response are in Britain and the former Soviet Union. And in the former Soviet Union, it's mixed. And as a result, there is a very different attitude towards war, towards defense expenditure, towards international institutions, towards ways of addressing international crises, which is not just the function of, as it were, having landed from Mars in the one case and Venus on the other, but having experienced a very, very different 20th century. 20th century was really good for this country. It went from being relatively small to being very large, from being quite provincial to being hugely cosmopolitan, culturally, intellectually, politically. It went from being arguably the third, possibly even the fourth military power to being easily, and by a long chalk, the first military power, and so on. Also, of course, it went from being a marginal country in world affairs to, for all these reasons, plus the fact that it spoke the international language, to being the dominant country in world affairs. Every European country has exactly, of any significance, has exactly the reverse history of going from dominance to marginality, from colonial power to local European state, from important country to less important country. And with one exception, my own country, they've learnt that lesson rather well. My own country still suffers from occasional delusions. The result of this difference is what we think of as the European welfare state. And I'm going to finish indirectly on this point. Comments on the welfare state in conventional history books and in this country in particular, and by pundits and op-ed pages, typically describe it as socialistic and typically treat it as the sort of either admirable but ineffective or dysfunctional and doomed consequence of European illusions about having your cake and eating it and so on. Now, it's true that, in fact, Europeans, West Europeans, live by every measure longer, healthier, better lives than most Americans of the same class, gender, age, and so on. But leaving that aside, there is an assumption that even if that's true, it can't last. Why did this come into being? It's not because a bunch of Europeans woke up in 1945 and said, time for social democracy. Who built the welfare states? They were built by old men, and I do mean men. Winston Churchill was born in 1874. Konrad Adenauer, the German Chancellor from 1949 to 1963, was born in 1876. Clement Attlee, the Labour Prime Minister who presided over the construction of the British welfare state, was born in 1883. The youngest of that cohort is Jean Monnet, the man whose plan reconstructed both France and Europe. He was born in 1888. Other men, de Gasperi, Alcide de Gasperi and Luigi Einaudi, the dominant politicians in post-war Italy, were both born in the 1870s. And William Beveridge, the man whose plan was the basis of the British welfare state, was born in 1879, and I won't go on. The point I'm making is simply this, that the men who were in charge of making, remaking, rebuilding, reconstructing, putting back together post-war Europe, particularly post-war Western Europe, were all in their 60s. They had grown up as adults in the Victorian and Edwardian era, the liberal era of the last generation of pre-World War I peaceful, prosperous, imperial Europe. They were very conscious that what had happened was a civilizational catastrophe. Europe had undergone a 30-year civil war from 1914 to 1945 and couldn't risk doing it again. They also believed, by and large, that what had gone wrong was that there had been insufficient institutional and political bulwarks against the consequences of insecurity, against the consequences of depression, of unemployment, of desperation. The general view in 1945, for many years afterwards, was that fascism is born of economic desperation, particularly among the lower middle class and the working class, and what you have to do is somehow prevent it ever happening again. And the welfare states, in that sense, were prophylactic. They were put in place to prevent going back to the past, not to create wonderful new futures. These were not men who dreamed of a socialist future. They were in their 60s and 70s. They were remembering a better past and trying to prevent a recurrence of the worst past. What has happened in Europe today, and it's quite striking when I go back there, is that the residual beneficiaries of the welfare state, my generation, the generation came after me, take for granted precisely the institutions, the legislation, the arrangements, the conditions, the guarantees that went with the welfare states in one form or another as these men built them. And that's true from social democratic Scandinavia to post-Franco Spain to Italy to Britain to the German Rhineland model to Austria. And these have been astonishingly successful institutions. Not economically, they've been economically successful, but they've been politically successful. There was no revival of fascism. Communism didn't get a hold politically, even in those countries like France and Italy, where initially there was a large communist party. Politically, West Europe has gone through an astonishing period of stability, security, comfort, ease, in ways that are very hard to explain to Americans. My wife is American, and we lived for 2 years in Vienna, in Austria, in the 1990s, and it was her first long period of time living in a European city. And she was completely bemused. She said, the shops are never open. Everyone is prosperous. Everyone's always on vacation, skiing. Everyone seems to have a convertible VW Golf. There's hardly any crime. You could eat your dinner off the tramway lines. How does it work? Well, this isn't the subject of my lecture, but I'd be happy to try and answer the question. But it does work. And the consequence of it working is that most Europeans under the age of 40 don't think about it. And this is now one of the problems. Because if there is a single, well, there are said to be two problems facing Europe, one of which is economic inefficiency and a need to reform laws about employment and so on. And that's actually marginal because those are relatively small changes that are needed. And what's lacking is political courage, not economic resources. The bigger problem is this. The most successful welfare states, and this is my final point, I'll end on this. The most successful European welfare states, Sweden, Denmark, the Netherlands, easily the most successful in terms of quality of life, expectation of life, standard of living, anything you care to say, anything you care to name, were all very homogenous countries. In fact, the whole of Europe was homogenous, something we forget now because, again, it's not part of a past that's very attractive to think about. But thanks to Stalin and Hitler, minorities disappeared. Hitler killed the Jews, a number of others as well. And then when the Russians came in, the Germans, the minorities were all pushed out of the room in the countries where they'd killed the Jews. And as a result, countries that, like Poland, before the Second World War had been 64% Polish, with the remainder being Ukrainians, Jews, Germans, and in religious terms, Eastern Orthodox, Jewish, Protestant, were now 98-99% Polish-speaking Catholics. And the same was true across the rest of Europe. Europe was white and homogenous. And because of decolonization, a generation of Europeans grew up that had very little contact with the non-European world. They came back, the Dutch, for example, came back from Indonesia in 1949 and became wholly European. The French, in a manner of speaking, did the same. So did the British. Not perhaps wholly European, but at any rate not any longer colonial. And the consequence is that Europeans lived through a period that no one would have wanted to bring about the way it was brought about, but that had huge advantages. It was a homogenous, youthful, white, internally undivided set of cultures in which the welfare state, which hinges heavily on trust, which requires that you believe the next generation will pay for you just as you paid for the previous generation, works very well. And now what is happening is that Europe is once again exposed to the outside world, to minorities, religious minorities, physically different people who are black and brown, Muslims above all, but not only. Not a huge statistical presence, maybe 16, 17 million Muslims in a continent of over 240 million, but very physically visible for the first time. And what is happening is it's exactly in those marvelously successful, small, homogenous welfare states, the Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, that you're seeing the rise of parties whose only issue is anti-immigration, anti-Muslim. Kick them out, require that they be like us, and so on. The very same people who in Holland are obsessed with their guilt about what was done to the Jews and who bend over backwards to say nice things about Jews and to memorialize the nasty things that they helped the Germans do to them, now say about Muslims exactly the things they used to say about Jews. If only they dressed differently, if only they ate differently, if only they were like us, if they could adapt more, if they could assimilate more, if they didn't have their own language, their own restaurants, their own habits, if they intermarried more, then it would work. And everyone, including very benign people just like us, say, it's true. But if you put the word Jew in there and take out the word Muslim, it sounds pretty awful. It sounds like the 1930s. But Europeans don't hear that. And if there is a problem in Europe today, it is this inability to see that behind their conscience-driven welfare state constructed overarching memory of how bad the past was and how they must avoid it, they are in fact turning in on themselves and failing to see that they're now facing a new challenge for the first time really since 1945, and that their response to it is in certain ways evidence of how little they have learned from the past despite being obsessed by it. I'll stop with that and be happy to take questions.
Folks, I think most of you know how this works. If you put your hand up, please wait for the mic. I'll call on you. We'll get a mic to you, and you can ask your question. I'd appreciate it if you keep your statements focused and your questions succinct. Gentleman right there. It's on.
So, how do you do research for a book like this? I was in the lobby. The book is this thick. It's wonderful. It's great. You do the research yourself. You have assistants. How do you do this?
Well, thank you very much for the question. Thank you for what you just said. It's terribly tempting to be flippant and say I'm now on my third wife. And it is very tough on one's family. I have two youngish children. And, well, what one does, I don't have research assistants. I only used one research assistant, wonderful graduate student of mine, for collecting a huge number of statistical series, which is simply a question of gathering them all up and putting them in order and so on. But I do my own work, and that's why it took so long. I started to think about it 15 years ago. You read literally hundreds and hundreds of books. You decide how you're going to sort out the topics. You design the book in your head and then onto a yellow pad so that you have dozens of categories and topics. And then you sit down in a very disciplined way in 1991 or whenever it is, and you say, okay, here's my reading plan for the next 10 years. In as many languages as I can manage. And then sometimes you go and do archival work if you want to follow up a particular thing. Mostly, inevitably, it's based on printed sources. And you call on, God, this sounds sort of terribly prim, but you call on a lifetime of reading. And you really do. I mean, it's also unusual in that this is a book about my own lifetime. And we historians are not supposed to do that because A, no distance, B, inadequate sources, C, you know, changing interpretations, opinions, no one quite knows what the story looks like. I had one huge advantage which overcame one of those, and that is Mr. Gorbachev. Because the Soviet Union fell, and with it communism, the archives, the government information that's available about the way communist societies were governed, the way communist states worked, the motives of, say, the Russians in 1956 in invading Hungary, or their response to Czechoslovakia in 1968, are open and available. Not completely. Putin has closed things back up again in many ways. But you can find out much more about what Moscow was doing than you can about what Washington was doing, for example, because the government in Washington didn't fall, and therefore the archives are still held in secret. And so we have the reverse position than usually. We know much more about closed societies than we do about open ones, which is why I wanted to write so much about Eastern Europe, because there is now so much more to say. But I guess, honestly, well, what I've just said with one other thing, and that is, I don't think you can write this kind of history except as a narrative. I mean, how you construct the narrative is a function of how you see the story, and you've got to think what kind of a story you want to tell. But it is a narrative, and there's no point telling it as separate little blocks. And so the hardest thing for me was integrating the narrative, so that without artificially connecting things, that it all somehow sort of flowed in. But, you know, I actually can't remember how I did it. It really is true. Sorry.
Next question. Gentleman in the blue suit right here.
A lot of recent books, such as While Europe Slept or Londonistan or Murder in Amsterdam, seem to all be dealing with what you spoke about right at the end. And I wonder, although you are a historian, if you could put on your political science hat for a minute and tell us whether you think this group that's coming from the Maghreb or the Middle East or wherever can assimilate into the European welfare state. Where do you see this going?
All right, well, it's the question. Because if we get it wrong, or Europeans get it wrong, then Europe and the Middle East are going to be very unpleasant places for the next two generations. The last election in the Netherlands that took place last week produced a shift to the political extremes, right and left, which have in common only their obsession with this subject. The first thing, I think, is to recall this. There is no such thing as Muslims any more than there are Christians. You have to make the same distinctions that we make between Germans and Poles, or between Poles and Ukrainians, or between the English and Latvians when you're looking at Muslim societies. If you take the Netherlands, there are three Muslim immigrant groups: Iranians, Turks, and Moroccans. Any Dutch person will tell you, I was in Holland a few weeks ago, so this is sort of on my mind. Any Dutch person will tell you that the Iranians are great. They're educated. They want to integrate. They're mostly not terribly religious, either in practice or in appearance. And they smoothly become Dutch, as it were. Turks are sort of middle. They're not terribly religious, but they don't assimilate very well. They live a very different lifestyle, and they're not necessarily well-educated, etc. But the Moroccans, useless, hopeless, backward in the treatment of women, in the education that they give themselves and their children, in their willingness or non-willingness to integrate, in their obsession with religious identity rather than political identity and so on. Well, you know, be careful, because you then go to Belgium, and they'll tell you, oh, Moroccans are okay. The real problem is the Algerians. And of course, that's what the French will tell you too. What's going on here is that all Muslims are fundamentally different from most Europeans. But they're not different because one group is Muslim and the other Christian and then some are Jews. It's because Europe is almost completely secular. If the Muslims from particularly Turkey or Iran had landed in Western Europe in 1928, let's say, they would have been very comfortable. I mean, they would not have been comfortable. They would have been abused and mistreated. But they would have, in one sense, been very at home in a world where religion, religious behavior, religious laws, censorship, identification with your religious community was the dominant feature of life. In the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Germany, particularly those three, because those are countries where you have Catholics and Protestants, and the Protestants are divided between Calvinists and Lutherans. Each of these groups lived in what Dutch call pillars. Belgians use the same word. You're born Catholic. You're educated Catholic. You church Catholic. You marry. You date Catholic. You marry Catholic. You shop Catholic. And you die Catholic. And you vote Catholic. And ditto Protestant. And that was true and had been true in these countries into the 60s, when suddenly there was, you know, cataclysmic change. Go to Holland now, and it is a country, sort of in cliched terms, particularly Amsterdam, where everything is for sale, there's tolerance of anything, sex, drugs, etc., etc. If you could imagine getting into a time machine and going to Amsterdam in 1958, it sort of Peoria with a port. I mean, it was a small provincial town where everyone went to church. No, forget Peoria. You've got to go much further south, somewhere in Arkansas. Everyone went to church. Everyone identified only with people of their own religion. You could tell what religion they were by their clothing. They were, however, all the same color. And that, of course, is what made eventually the disappearance of religion possible. But the Muslims are arriving in a Europe which, except in a few countries in Eastern Europe, is totally secular in a way that Americans can't really imagine. America hasn't changed since the 50s in that respect. Rip Van Winkle fell asleep here and woke up in mid-50s and woke up now. In some respects, this country would be very familiar. Suburbia, religious practice, the importance attached in small communities to conformism and morally appropriate behavior and so on. The same person going to sleep in Europe in 1950s and Western Europe and waking up 50 years later would see something dramatically different. And so the Muslims have arrived in this place which is very inhospitable to them, in part because it has changed so much and they haven't. But the Europeans have made very little effort to assimilate Muslims. There have been two models, and neither of them has worked. There's been the Anglo-Dutch model, which is basically as much multiculturalism as you want. You have your own schools, you can wear your own clothes, you can speak your own languages to each other, do your own thing, just that, you know, you can't ever really become us. But you can be you in Rotterdam but you can't be me because I'm Dutch, and that's different. And the English are not quite as aggressively sort of definitive in that sense, in that approach to multiculturalism, but the outcome is similar. The alternative model is the French model. And the French are so completely committed to the notion of integration, assimilation, that they don't, in fact, do statistical surveys of people's religious or ethnic identification or affiliation. So it's very hard to know the real figures for the number of Muslims in France, because national statistics don't provide them, because that's regarded as invidious and selective. Once you're French, you're French. Now, of course, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way in the suburbs. But be careful, the French suburbs, the god-awful outer suburbs, what used to be the communist working, white working class suburbs, which are now mostly third generation North African or sub-Saharan African or to some extent West Indian suburbs. The trouble there is not religion. Most of those kids burning cars haven't been inside a mosque in their lives. And many of them don't even speak Arabic. They are angry about being excluded from France, but it's not as though they wake up each morning feeling Muslim. However, and this is a different topic, they do wake up each morning feeling very anti-Jewish, often, and that's connected with the Israel-Palestine conflict. And that's another story, which is, in a way, connected to your question. How could Europeans address this? Well, the first thing they could do is admit Turkey to the European Union. This is a very, very big question, because there is no paper reason why Turkey shouldn't be admitted and, say, Bulgaria admitted. You can come up with reasons why Bulgaria is more European, but when people have that conversation, they get stuck. Serbia is European, Ukraine is European, but Turkey isn't. It's not about religion, it's about values, it's about cultural heritage, etc. Well, you know, it's about failing to acknowledge genocide of the Armenians. That is a legitimate point. But when it comes to genocides, Christian Europeans have got it all over the Muslims every time in the 20th century. What the Serbs did to the Bosnians, what the Croats did to the Serbs and Jews, what the Germans did to everyone, what the Ukrainians did to Poles and Jews, what the Poles did to Ukrainians, are far, far worse in terms of human rights abuse and sheer mass criminality than the Turks have done to anyone, even their own Kurds in the 20th century, and the Turks have been bad enough. So that doesn't wash. The truth of the matter is, it's that the Turks are Muslims and everyone else is Christian, and that's why people who are against having them don't want them. There's an argument that 72 million Turks, most of whom are poor, don't fit in Europe. But proportionately, Ukraine would be far, far worse in terms of poverty and numbers. But Ukraine is in principle acknowledged as potentially a member of the European Union down the line, whereas many people are against having Turkey. Turkey is much more part of European history than many of the existing member countries in some ways. And of course, we have Muslims in the European Union already, not only the ones I've talked about, but the 10 or 11 million who live in Bulgaria. 10 or 11% of the Bulgarian population who are Muslim, Bosnian Muslims who are candidates for, excuse me? Sorry. Albanians, except not yet in the European Union, but recognized as legitimate candidates. If Europeans don't take Turkey, and that's what looks likely to happen with politicians like Angela Merkel in Germany or Sarkozy in France or Ségolène Royal in France, either anti-Turkey or willing to go along with whatever they think political opinion, public opinion will be in their country. Firstly, this will give huge encouragement to the far right because it legitimizes their position, which has been that Europe has too many Muslims and too many minorities and needs to draw its lines and so on. But also, it will be a catastrophe for the Middle East. It will be a catastrophe for Turkey, in ways we could talk about, but it will be a catastrophe for the Middle East, because Turkey is the secularized Muslim country par excellence, with, particularly in Istanbul, an educated, Europeanized, English-speaking, professional, non-religious elite of young people who want to be Europeans and who have thrown in their lot psychologically with the vision of themselves as Europeans. Close the door to them, and we will turn not only them, and with them Turkey, but the whole Middle East, away from Europe as a possible solution to the East-West Muslim, non-Muslim division. So I'm very, very worried about the European turn against Turkey. If it went the other way, I think there is no huge issue at all. There's a big issue of education. The problem has been that ever since people who were black or brown and Muslim, either practicing or by inheritance, started to come to Europe in large numbers and have children and become a physical presence in the cities of Western Europe, the far right has exploited that on straightforward racial grounds. And as a result, the mainstream center and the center left has stayed quiet about it, not wanting to be thought racist by even raising the question, and therefore handing people like Le Pen something like 18-19% of the vote on this issue. The worst case is Antwerp, a very prosperous city, in fact the most prosperous city in the most prosperous part of one of the most prosperous countries in the most prosperous continent the world has ever known. In Antwerp, at the last local election, 34% of the votes went for the so-called Vlaams Belang, which is the far-right party, which is a single-ticket party, which is basically anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant. And a significant majority, sizable majority of the Antwerp Jewish community voted for that party as well, which, by the way, is the direct heir of the Flemish fascist parties of the Second World War. So there's a real political issue in Europe around this. And it's about political education. It's about explaining to young people and to voters that it is possible to assimilate without denying identity differences, that it is possible to address the so-called question of the veil, which is very often the symbolic issue on which all these debates hang, because a tiny, tiny minority of young women actually want to wear the veil in the places and on the occasions where public policy and public opinion is against it. But this has been turned into the big cultural issue facing Europe today. Somehow political leadership has to reverse it. That would be my answer. It's not a terribly profound one, I'm afraid.
A few more questions in the third row right here, this lady.
Thank you very much for your learned talk today. I'm going to ask another political science question, in that I couldn't help but be struck by the parallels today. And, you know, I'm not saying anything like the Holocaust is going on, but we're not talking about the extraordinary rendition and the tortures that are happening in Eastern Europe and the sort of threads of fascism that are coming up in the American psyche. And I just wondered if you would comment on that.
Yeah, I will. It wasn't my subject, so I didn't talk about it. But, you know, we have devoted ourselves both rhetorically and historically in this country in the last 60 years to what we have seen as struggles against bad societies. And the measure of their badness has been torture, for example. Read Yevgenia Ginzburg's account of her arrest and being sent to Stalin's camps. Read Josephine Langer's account of being a victim of a show trial in Bratislava in Slovakia in the 1950s. And then read how they were tortured, and then go and read about the tortures that we use, and you will find they are remarkably similar. Water torture, being forced to stand in cold cells for hours, being forced to stand for hours, being pressed to write confessions, and if they won't write confessions, being sent back to a frozen cell until they do. Now, it's true that we don't do this to our own citizens, whereas the countries that we fought against were doing it to their own citizens. But let's be careful here. In the Second World War, Marshal Pétain in France drew a sharp distinction between Jews who were citizens of France and Jews who were not citizens. The Jews who were citizens of France were to be protected, habeas corpus applied. They were not to be handed over to the Germans. Non-citizens could be treated any old way, and more precisely, could be sent to Auschwitz. Marshal Antonescu in Romania made a big deal of saving the Romanian Jews, but only the Jews who were the children of Romanian citizens. Jews who were non-citizens, aliens, could be treated any old way. Rendition, as it were, applied to them, and they could be sent off to camps and were, and in most cases were killed. After the Second World War, we took part in a series of trials. And among the trials that we encouraged were the trials of Marshal Petain, Marshal Antonescu in Romania. And they were tried, among other things, for precisely these distinctions, these invidious distinctions, where you removed human and civil and legal rights from some people because they weren't citizens. And it was regarded as no defense whatsoever that you protected those who were citizens. Well, we do just that. We are in danger, without realizing it, of slipping step by little step, you know, not into a fascist regime. One mustn't exaggerate, and also one mustn't make the mistake of historical analogy. This is not 1938, and we're not living in Germany. We're not about to rerun some grotesque experience from the past. Much more serious is that we are in danger of losing our republic. We're in danger of doing in little ways the things that, when they are done in big ways, define precisely the countries, the cultures, the doctrines that we have fought against. And, you know, as we are now living out an aspect of George Orwell's 1984, if you remember, and I'm sure people here do, how in a condition of permanent eternal war, it was possible for the leadership always to argue that there was a reason why you had to express your loyalty and insist upon your support for the leadership and never oppose it, because there was always, despite the fact that we were always, this is 1984, remember, we're always winning the war, somehow at the same time there's always a grave danger that has to be faced domestically, and that's why the government has to be even stronger. Not to mention, anyone remember the 2 minutes hate? That was part of the mandatory experience in 1984. Well, anyone who's listened to talk radio in this country in the last few years or watched Fox News knows all about 2 minutes hate. In little ways, we're slipping. And it matters not that it's about politics. It's about civil society. It's we who have to not slip. Politicians will always slip if they can. And so, yes, I mean, I think we are in a very bad way. I remain, I have to admit, completely perplexed that people in this country, people of goodwill, are not astonished that we should want to have made war as an act of political choice when we didn't have to. Stop and think about that. Hitler was, not Hitler, he was dead. Goering was tried at Nuremberg for making aggressive war. That was the first of the four counts in the Nuremberg trials. It was making war as a policy rather than war as a defensive act or last resort. How did it come about that we thought that this was an all right thing to do? Leave aside the question of whether we believed there was a real threat or a real danger or a real issue, and whether we believed that getting democracy in the Middle East and thereby solving the Middle East was a worthwhile objective. None of that gets around the fact that we chose to treat war, and a war in which we could not get international agreement, so it meant going against all the international agencies and all the international agreements that we set up, we collectively, but primarily America, set up in the decades after the Second World War. We chose to ignore those and simply make war as an act of policy. This is catastrophic, not just because of what's happened in this particular war. It's much more serious than that. It's because we are no longer in a position to render ourselves as a moral example of how the well-regulated state should behave in the international community. And that undermines us much, much more than any number of external threats, real or imaginary. That's my opinion.
You know what? I'm going to take my cue from the audience. We'll head upstairs for book signing. Please thank Tony Judd.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.